Okay, welcome to OS News Podcast, episode number 23, of the week, Saturday, 29th of August, 2009. This week, introductions, let's do that. As usual, I'm Croc Kamen, and joined with the usual panellist.
Tom Howarder.
But we'll also have two more additions to the show, so our Linux guru from last week, it's Tess.
Hello.
And we've also happy to have OS News owner David Adams on the line.
Greetings.
Greetings, programs.
Greetings, nerds.
Okay. How's people's weeks been?
I've got a new display. I've got a lot more room now.
I have been reorganizing courseware all week, so I'm pretty tired.
I finally got a major boost to my productivity in that I finally have my scanner set up to do automatic, like scripted to do character recognition automatically. So,
awesome.
Whenever I have a paper, I just run it through the scanner, and then I don't have to worry about it anymore. Paperless office for the win.
Fantastic. Okay. Let's get started on topics today. We've got a number of things this week, so we're going to have to pick and choose what we like. Everything fits within this in the first page. So, do you know where we're going to start, Tom?
Well, we're starting on Snow Leopard, which I know nothing about.
Well, yeah, we can cover the Snow Leopard stuff if you want. I don't think that'll take too long, so there are other meaty subjects there. David, are you on Snow Leopard yet?
No, this is actually the only major Apple operating system upgrade that I have not had installed like months and weeks before it actually released. This is the only time I wasn't, installing like every like buggy developer preview. And the interesting thing is I actually was very, very highly anticipating Snow Leopard. I actually think a lot of it has to do with the fact that I was working in an office and was really looking at an office that used Microsoft Exchange, and I was really looking forward to using the new Microsoft Exchange oriented features. But then I lost that job, and I think that my enthusiasm for trying that out turned into what's the opposite of enthusiasm?
Resentment?
Despair.
So I think I've got a little bit of an emotional block going
on. All right, it needs me to speak about it then. It's not much, as we all know, it is not much like the previous upgrades. It is not such a massive a feature fest as they usually are. I mean, I installed Snow Leopard. It took 45 minutes. And then you're just left with your desktop, and then you just get on. Really, you just get on with it. There's nothing much to say about it. They've polished a number of things. It is marginally faster. Windows Mail. Mail.app is significantly faster. Of all the apps that matter, Mail.app, they've really obviously done as much optimization as possible with that. But generally, it feels pretty much the same across the board. A lot of the benefits, I think, aren't going to come until a bit further down the line, until everybody's updated their apps and starting to make use of things like Grand Central Dispatch, etc., 64-bit binaries, and so forth. And there's other parts of it where they do their usual, they make things different, and they make them look different for no real apparent reason. And it's just, it's annoying, but I suppose in the end you get used to it. Exposure has changed a lot. And what's really, really weird is that in Exposé, when you enter it, when you mouse over each of the windows, you get this bright hexadecimal FF blue border around the windows, which is like, what on earth? It looks like something out of MS Paint. And It's nasty, but I suppose I get used to it in the end. And it orders everything into a grid now instead of just loosely based on their positions beforehand. So it's kind of disorientating to begin with, but you'll get used to it. And like the right-click menus on applications, they're now all black, and it's like, what's that supposed to be? Why have you got this sort of menu HUD mix that makes no sense? Why isn't just a normal menu good enough? And just odd things like that. They do that with every operating system release.
The right-click menu is black?
Yep, you right-click on it, and it's like a black glass effect. Not the right context menu for everything, only on the applications on the dock, which makes no sense at all, because they were normal menus before, and they're still effectively normal menus, but now they just have a different look. So just weird, pointless, needless things like that. They always do that.
Kind of like what they did with the semi-pseudo 3D dock in Leopard. Completely useless and pointless.
Yes.
Doesn't make any sense. It looks ugly, and nobody really liked it from the start.
Yeah. Okay,
and now everybody's using it except me.
Not me.
No, me neither.
QuickTime X is I actually installed QuickTime 7 is installed as well as a utility in the utilities folder, because QuickTime X doesn't have any proper functions. It has no exporting functions. Well, it's got exporting functions, but there are zero options. You can choose YouTube or you can choose any Apple product. It's like a completely Apple-centric universe.
And oh dear.
Yeah, it's horrible. And the application as well, QuickTime X, they removed Command 2, which is really annoying, because you could do Command 1 for actual size, Command 2 for double size, Command 3 will fit to screen, and they remove Command 2. And instead, you're supposed to use Command minus and plus to increase and decrease the size of the video. But the QuickTime, you can still include QuickTime 7 in your actual install and just associate your files with that. So it's you know, not vitally important.
And what about the weird interface? Because, of course, QuickTime is not just a media player. It's the entire media layer, basically. But couldn't really... I haven't used it, obviously, but it was kind of weird to me that when you have a video window open, that it's just the video. There's no Chrome, there's no nothing, except when you mouse over. That sounds really weird to me.
Well, it's not that weird. It's just that it's slow to do anything. It's really only good for things where you want to start it playing and then leave it. It's for films. It's not for short stuff, because every time you move your mouse, all your interface comes back again. Then you've got to wait for it to disappear.
Yeah,
and for some reason, it doesn't play. It doesn't automatically start playing. You've got to click play, and there's no preferences for it either, so you can't get it to automatically start playing. And, I mean, generally what I found in the very short time I've been using Snow Leopard, which is just today, basically, I've noticed one thing, which I think is a kind of a problem that Apple are heading towards, and that I'm not sure they know how to deal with it at the moment, and that is that they've got too many media interfaces. In Snow Leopard, it's particularly eclectic. A video file has now previews inside the actual icon, so in Finder you can click on the icon and it will start playing the video inside the actual icon, which is annoying because I'm used to clicking in the center of icons to select them, and then that just actually plays the damn video, and I don't want it to do that. So you keep getting hit by sound every time. So now you've got to think where you're clicking, which is the mental noise you don't want. Second to that is that, as well as being able to play them like that, you can also press space and you can use Quick Look, and that's a different media interface. But you can also open up in QuickTime X, and you can play them into that, and that's another media interface. But then you've got the stuff in iTunes, and that's got its own media interface as well for playing videos.
Yeah, I don't get why they would want to have live previews, because Quick Look is one of my favorite features of the entire operating system, exactly because it's a good it's a really good intermediary between an icon and and opening the actual program. It's the perfect intermediary. It's like a three-step process. You have an icon with a title, you have Quick Look, and the actual application. It's perfect. But now the icon is also a sort of mini Quick Look kind of thing. Again, I haven't used it, but it sounds really convoluted to me, way too complicated to have. I'm sure it looks really cool, but what's the point, really? I mean, I just don't really...
This is kind of an issue that it actually makes me want to bring up a kind of a more philosophical question. But, you know, you see, to some extent, both Apple and Microsoft with their latest operating system releases. And, I don't know, in some cases like this, it almost seems like they're grasping at straws in order to come at a new, in order to add a new feature, and whenever you're going to try to add a new feature for the sake of adding a new feature, you're running the risk of actually making it worse. But the philosophical question that I'd like to bring up to the group is, do you think that we may have entered into a new era where we see major operating system releases that aren't filled with lots of new features, that are, you know, foundational, fundamental, you know, improving kind of under the skin things? Like,
well, I think that we are, actually, because if you look at just what happened with the netbook phenomenon, why did that become so popular? It was, you know, they were cheap. And what did they do? They did the things that most users actually do with systems today. They browse the net, and they might work on Office documents of some sort. And that was more than enough for most people. And it gets to a point that perhaps, you know, adding more features for the sake of adding features has really kind of jumped the shark in terms of what we can do with OSs. Why don't we focus on optimizing and refining? Well, the problem is that as a business, that's not very sustainable. You want to make more features so that you could sell it to more people, so that you can draw in more funding. That's how these things work. But you don't want to overgrow it with so many features.
And we passed a really important milestone a few years ago, I'd say maybe 4 or 5 years ago. And that was the hardware milestone, where the cheapest computer you could possibly buy in the marketplace was too fast for your average computer user to be able to need any, even that amount of computing power. and that also spawned the netbook phenomenon, because, you know, literally, you can, this is the only time that I know of in my lifetime where you can have a four-year-old computer that does not need to be upgraded because it's too slow.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And that has been and is going to continue to be a serious problem for hardware vendors, who have always been able to count on not just Moore's Law making it cheaper and faster, but that they've been counting on the people's dissatisfaction with the speed of their current machines. But now I think we're reaching a similar milestone with the operating system.
Yeah, well, they need to expose the features that are already there in a better way so that people can make use of them. And I suppose in a lot of ways, this is what the preview thumbnails in Snow Leopard are. It's a single-click way with an icon to do it. Because Quick Look is an entirely hidden feature. There's no... You have to know to press the space key. You can put a button on... There's a button on the toolbar for it, but that's disconnected from the icon that you're clicking. So I suspect not many people even find it. And so what they're trying to do is just expose existing functionality, and these modern operating systems do have so much functionality, and it's like the Office 2007 thing, is that you can make a new version that has no new features, but is just exposing the functionality in a better way. I think in order for them to succeed in doing that, we're going to have to change how we ship operating systems and how often we ship operating systems. They're going to have to be much regular, much smaller, and we've got to start moving to a model of completely online operating system distribution, that you all just download your operating system each year.
Yeah, basically what, for instance, more integrated devices are already doing, right? I mean, if you have a, for instance, if you look at the Xbox, I mean, there's not, or even the PlayStation, there's nothing to install, actually. All happens automatically through the... through the internet, game upgrades or system upgrades to the system software itself. It all happens automatically, transparently. There's not really anything to worry about. You don't have to actively think about upgrading or all the stuff. It all happens automatically.
Unless you're running Homebrew.
Yeah, well, obviously. But you're always up to date, basically, if you stick to the normal...
Well, it's not just consoles that are having this. Look at portable devices like phones. I mean, RIM added in OS 4.5 the ability to wirelessly upgrade the OS. And WebOS does it in the background transparently, which I find a little bit suspicious, but... Nevertheless, that is something that you can do with these devices. I mean, all of this operating system management that we're used to as tech heads might be something that we won't have to worry too much about in the future. That's also a danger, because then we're giving away a part of our control over our own hardware to some other vendor.
That's inevitable. they move to cheaper systems for distributing, maintaining, selling operating systems, the cost to produce them and manage them and everything is coming down, and that's going to naturally push them towards being always on and always connected and always up to date, and that's a good thing for security. You look at what Google are doing with Chrome browser, and that model might apply to their Chrome OS, so that that you will have an operating system that you don't have to update because it always is up to date.
Well, and if you think about, you know, kind of going back to what we were saying earlier about netbooks and your typical computer user, you know, really being pretty satisfied with what an operating system, even an older one like Windows XP, can do.
Mm-hmm.
If Google is going to succeed in making a browser UI based operating system, you know, that by definition is really going to constrain, or at least somewhat constrain, the capabilities and kind of take it back to its most basic.
That's
not
true.
Not necessarily.
Carry on, Tess.
Well, I've recently been alpha testing Jala Cloud, one of the new cloud-based OSs, on my aunt's Asus E4G way, way back when. And everything on it, all the applications, are really browser applications using Mozilla Prism. And I actually found that really kind of handy, because if I ever have a problem with the device, all my files are still out there in the cloud somewhere. And the operating system also transparently updates pretty much everything on the system, with the exception of a very few applications, are really browser-based apps, but it feels like a regular operating system for a netbook. I actually found it a very effective combination.
Yeah, but do you...
Well, you know, I'm actually looking forward to that new world, because, you know, I've gotten a little bit of a taste of that as I, with setting up my system. I guess my workflow between my iPhone, my laptop, and I have a Mac laptop and a Windows desktop that I use. And, you know, I've actually set up most of my everyday productivity applications so that I can use them on whichever device I happen to be on. And, you know, I think about the bad old days of not being able to kind of check your email or look at your to-do list or manage your documents, you know, at whatever computer you had to be. And I think, man, how did I live like that? And that's definitely the future, I think, to some extent.
I'm kind of used to sending and receiving all my email on my BlackBerry. I'm probably just, you know, one of those business slaves.
We didn't even have BlackBerries here, so for me it's all popular. I do have a Hotmail account, and I do even have a Gmail account, but I don't use them, mostly because I'm the only person in the entire world, everywhere, I mean, I'm the only one who cannot use the Gmail interface, because I find it very confusing. So I'm still using, you know, a regular old-fashioned email client, and I actually prefer that. But
I think what we're seeing... there's an interesting thing. I think that we're moving into this idea of computing in the cloud and all that, as horrible word
wow.
that is, and we haven't solved all the problems. We're not certain how to do it all, and it doesn't seem like such a good idea at this time. And it's a bit like when the web really started to take off, when its growth begun was exponential, when it was a new idea, and people thought, hey, we can start putting stuff on the web. It's completely impractical, but it's cool. And so we got the birth of the intranet and things like that. That they had these systems that were extremely difficult to program, very time consuming, not really the best way of doing it, but it worked. And we're doing the same sort of thing with moving to the cloud. It's very difficult at the moment. We haven't got all the problems solved, certainly. Things, you know, with web browsers not being able to access APIs like the web camera and playing DVDs or just, you know, things like that. You
not to mention the intellectual property issues.
Yes.
Yeah.
But I think that the human nature is forcing us that way, and so we're going to get over those hurdles eventually. And in the interim, there'll be early adopters, and at the moment, you can get by perfectly fine not having to touch the cloud whatsoever.
How did we get here, starting from Snow Leopard, actually? I'm just trying to get everything back to where we started.
Mm.
How did we get here? We got here via, let me think, I don't know. No, I don't recall how we got here.
Someone rewind the podcast and let us know how we got here.
Yeah.
It was just a meandering discussion.
Yeah.
I was just wondering.
Right, well, we're on Snow Leopard's news. Okay, well, it's been released, so we don't need to cover that. And we could, there's two other things that need to cover. One, just a quick mention of the anti-malware stuff. And two, the SciStar case. Yep.
Yeah, well, when it comes to the malware, there's a very rudimentary, very simple anti-malware feature inside macOS 10 Snow Leopard, which is using a file called xprotect, a plist file called xprotect, which is located somewhere deep in the system library directory, which basically is a simple file that contains two malware definitions for two trojans, for the most common between quotation marks, because I don't think they're common at all, but still. For two trojans, and basically what it does is it uses functionality introduced in Tiger, which would scan files downloaded through a limited set of applications.
I think scan is the wrong word. People have been using scan, but it's completely wrong word. All it is that, whenever you download a file, it gets tagged with an extended attribute to say that it's in quarantine, and then when you open the file, it says this: you downloaded this file from the internet. Are you sure? Okay. All they've done is just added a very simple if to that functionality that says if this download is got some attribute, something about it that's in this xprotect list, then it's a virus, and say you shouldn't be doing this. So
yeah,
it's not a malware scanner. Well, it's.
It technically, because it scans the files you downloaded.
Yeah, but
so
it's not like a scanning engine, like real-time virus protection that runs in the background, like people's traditional concepts of antivirus.
No,
it's nothing like that at all. It's the most primitive, basic shell script or something could do this.
Yeah, it's a passive scan, basically.
Yeah.
So it's a passive scan, and it's not an active scan, actually. But it's very rudimentary, because you can only use it on Safari, Firefox, iChat, Entourage, Mail, and
anything that's using the URL APIs in OS X, so that you can then track that.
It feels more like a very slightly rudimentary thing that they added just to basically some sort of quick and dirty hack, actually, just to let people know that Apple is doing something about it. But this is if the Mac was really actually in danger, if there were a lot of Trojans out there, this feature would be completely pointless. But since there are no since it's not really in danger right now, I mean, it suffices, but if the Mac really were ever to come under some serious attack, this feature wouldn't be enough. But that's all speculation and not really relevant right now. So,
okay. Next up,
Tiger.
Sorry,
should we mention that you can also upgrade from Tiger?
That's a good thing about Snow Leopard, and a surprising thing in this day and age. And the Snow Leopard disk is there's no activation, there's no license key, there's no anti-piracy measures. You are basically just Apple trusts you, which is an almost amazing thing to say. Their desktop business is not their iPhone business, which is what's so strange, is that they can get a desktop operating system so right, and yet they can't get a phone operating system right at all.
Well,
Apple actually trusts you to do
iPhone.
The right thing. There's you buy the disk and you can install as many computers as you want. You've only got one copy, one license for it, but they don't check you for that. And they say that it can only be installed on Leopard and upwards, but they don't check for that. And you can do it on Tiger and it works. So it's amazing compared to Windows 7.
Yeah, but it's not that
well.
Strange,
you know,
because
it's a good thing. Sorry. I was just going to say a flippant comment about all the trouble that Microsoft goes to make sure that that you can't improperly install Windows. That of course has completely stamped out all piracy of Microsoft Windows. So they've been 100% successful in making sure that nobody can pirate Windows.
Yeah, but it's obviously because the main source of income for Microsoft is software and not hardware. I mean, if I mean, if you're buying Snow Leopard, and even if you install it on 5 machines with just one license, Apple doesn't care because it already means you bought 5 machines, and that's where they get their money from. They're not getting their money from Snow Leopard.
The anti-piracy measures in Windows don't work and haven't ever worked. They only affect people.
Exactly,
with legitimate
I was being sarcastic.
They only affect legitimate customers. The only people who ever see the activation kick in and say this is not valid are genuine users. The pirates just remove the activation and just use Windows. So it's never worked, and all it does is it's a pain only for legitimate users. I think Microsoft would actually see a decline in piracy if they just lightened up.
I agree. And the truth is that you know, Apple having this kind of old fashioned, you know, just trying to make the experience good. It makes me you know, more like, and especially the fact that it only costs $29, it makes me more likely to feel like, even if I were the kind of person who normally wouldn't pay for software, I'd be like, well, maybe I can pay for this one.
Well, I'll give you one example. I've got a Windows XP Professional. It's the I had this back from 2001 when Windows came out, and it's travelled with me a long way. And whilst I own the copy of Windows, I've always installed a pirate copy because I don't want the activation. I've used it in virtual machines where I change the RAM now and again, or I change aspects about it. I don't want activation to kick in. I just want to get some damn work done.
I've never had any of those problems with upgrading hardware. Even
It's not so bad now. They did make corrections in Service Pack 3, so it's a little less brutal. But it's still fact of the matter that I don't want to have to phone Microsoft every time I change, you know, a component in my computer.
True.
Or virtual computer in this case, which makes it even more, you know, even more of a problem that you can't, you know, that you can chop and change stuff inside a virtual computer all the time. Not least if you're trying to dual boot or side boot a system so that you can access it in a virtual machine but also boot it for real. Mm-hmm. Which really gets on the activations go. That you know, it really sets the alarms off.
Yeah.
Okay, SciStar, this is our latest news item, and yet again more Apple news. Tom, could you cover this, please, because I'm not up to speed with this.
Okay, well, the latest news item, at least, is that, of course, there's a court case running called Apple versus SciStar Corporation, which is Apple suing SciStar, basically. But there's now a new lawsuit running. Yes, it's all getting very convoluted here, and this is a case which is started by SciStar in the District Court of Florida, if I'm not mistaken, in Miami, where SciStar is actually located, situated. And they basically, it more or less comes down to a separate case because of Snow Leopard. So it's unrelated to Leopard, but it's about Snow Leopard. And what SciStar is asking from the judge is an injunction against Apple because of Apple's anti-competitive attempts to tie macOS 10 Snow Leopard to its Macintosh line of computers. SciStar states in the filings for the lawsuit that they have already written code so that Snow Leopard can be installed on not Mac machines, basically. Which is not that big of a surprise because the test versions of Snow Leopard were already running on Hackintosh machines, have already been running on Hackintosh machines for months, so it's not really anything special about that one. But they also state that, let me see here, the manner in which SciStar computers run macOS 10 Snow Leopard is entirely different from the manner in which SciStar computers run macOS 10 Leopard. I have no idea why or how, because as far as I know, both, at least in the Hackintosh community, both Snow Leopard and Leopard Regular use some sort of variant of boot 132, or in any case, some sort of open source implementation of EFI, maybe tied to a customized Darwin kernel. It's you know, but still, those are both measures where you do not actually modify macOS 10. But basically, SciStar is asking the court for an. I'm just going to read this literally because else I'm going to get it wrong. The lawsuit asks the court for an injunction requiring Apple to cease tying Snow Leopard to Apple Macintosh machines. And it also asks for an injunction prohibiting Apple from blocking SciStar from selling computers with Snow Leopard pre-installed. So it's kind of a, I mean, if you're standing where SciStar is standing, this lawsuit actually makes total sense because SciStar built their entire business model around installing and reselling legal copies of macOS 10, which I still think they should be able to do, but that's just me. But in that case, any attempts by Apple to prevent SciStar from doing that can be seen as anti-competitive and as such an antitrust violation. from SciStar's perspective, of course, but I think SciStar kind of lost a lot of credibility over the last couple of months by being weird in general, by undertaking some slightly more questionable acts. And if you look at the entire history of the Apple versus SciStar court case, you'll see that the judge has already sided with Apple on a lot more occasions than it has sided with SciStar. So if you look at from now into the future, I think Apple has a pretty good, sadly, has a pretty good outlook for this case, which is kind of sad. But I think SciStar messed up in that regard. They could have gone about this on a much more slightly less annoying level, if you just put it like that. I mean, I still think that they, at its core, that SciStar is right. That they have justice on their side, to speak in a very American way. But I don't think that their actions are helping them with that goal. And that's kind of sad, because now this court case is no longer about the core aspect of a company being able to tell you what you can do with property that you bought and that you own. It's no longer about that. It's now about all sorts of side issues that both companies are bringing into the mix, and it's all convoluted and complicated anymore, and everything is steered away from the really weird thing, namely that stupid piece of paper that or stupid piece of text that you know that you are presented with way after your purchase, that somehow that little stupid piece of paper dictates what you can do with software that you bought. And that's actually, for me, still the core of the case. But because of all the extra stuff that's going on around it, it's no longer about that anymore. And of course, that is exactly Apple's goal. They don't want to talk about that stuff. They want to talk about copyright violations. They want to talk about possible DMCA violations. That's what Apple wants to talk about, because their SciStar is obviously wrong. But I still think that they, you know, they're kind of forced to be that way. They're forced to, you know, break the DMCA. They're forced to, you know, break some copyright laws, only to actually do what they should be able to do anyway, which is buy macOS 10, install it on a computer, and resell it. I mean, it's really simple. I just don't understand why this all has to be so completely complicated and difficult and everything. End of rant.
Well, Apple's really doesn't make their money from the software. They make it from the hardware. And this is basically SciStar attacking Apple's bottom line. Now, while I actually kind of side on the side of SciStar here, because I would very much like to be able to say, well, I don't want to buy Apple hardware because I think it's too expensive and it has incompatibilities with the other operating systems I run, but I'd be perfectly happy to put down money to give it a test drive on my hardware on my terms. But this kind of behavior just smacks of trying to maintain your market share using somewhat nefarious practices. It smells like the whole Internet Explorer browser inclusion debacle all over again.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree more. That's the correct saying. I mean, in the end, if Apple is selling standalone copies, even Snow Leopard, even though, of course, on the piece of paper it says it's an upgrade, but it's still, it's a complete copy of an operating system, and according to the laws that I live under, that copy is mine, and I'm allowed to do with that copy whatever I want. I even can make a number of copies and do what I want with that, as long as it's within my own home, right? I mean, I paid for that stuff, so that disk and the contents of the disk are mine, and I should be able to do with that content whatever I want. And if I want to stick it on a computer and resell it, I should be able to do so, whether it's a computer with an Apple label on it or not. And SciStar should be able to do the exact same thing. And Piercy, the European Mac cloner, should also be able to do the exact same thing. But you can also see that it's kind of weird here, because Apple is not suing Piercy. Well, Piercy is much bigger than SciStar, actually. It's because Piercy is selling in Germany, France, Belgium, and the Netherlands now. And they're not doing anything about that. They're just focusing on SciStar here, which I find kind of interesting, because I think it's more about being a deterrent than...
Well, they don't want to awake the sleeping giant of the EU Privacy Commission. Yeah, that's the thing. Here in the US, also, they can get away with that sort of stuff because the laws are more in favor of the companies. But in the EU, they don't want to wake the sleeping beast and end up with that entire market off of their charts. They don't want that.
Yeah, that's probably... Yeah,
well, I think it's important to mention, too, that Apple... you know, when they moved to Intel, I think that they realized that they were probably going to have to contend with, you know, hobbyists and hackers, you know, making Hackintoshes. Mm-hmm. I'm certain that they foresaw that, and they probably foresaw this type of SciStar thing. And you know, Apple hasn't seemed to have made many hasn't seemed to done much to try to put an end to the kind of the hobbyist stuff, because that doesn't necessarily represent a huge challenge to their core business.
Unless you're talking about the iPhone.
Well, I mean, I'm talking about the operating system.
Yeah.
But, you know, so I think that they would be happy to just go ahead and let, you know, kind of the hacker contingent, you know, fool around with their, with what they're doing. But, you know, Apple just still has this terrible, I think they're still traumatized by what happened when they opened up the Mac cloners, you know, back in the 90s.
Ah, the power computing thing.
Yes. Yeah, so from how I understand that, because obviously I was too young and I wasn't really following that, but basically what happened was that some of the Mac clones were actually a lot better and cheaper and faster than Apple's own machines, right?
What happened is power computing developed machines at the high end for what turned out to be what Apple realized was their most lucrative customers. And Apple wasn't capable of delivering a product that could compete with power computing because, for various reasons, because they had to develop in volume and they couldn't support the kind of customization and things like that. And so, you know, power computing basically took their most lucrative market away from them. And then they saw at the other end, they saw some other cloners lining up to take the other side of the market away, which is the, you know, stack 'em deep and sell 'em cheap side of the market, and basically leaving Apple only with the least profitable section of the market in the middle, and it might have put them out of business. Now, I think a lot of that had to do with the fact that Apple was extremely poorly run at that point in their history, and they didn't really have their act together. So I don't know whether it's irrational for them to be that afraid of that happening to them again, but...
Yeah, but in the end, it's for me, it's not about the fear. I mean, I've said it before. I don't care about companies, you know. I mean, in the end, what I care about is consumers. And if Apple is afraid of that, well, that's their problem, not mine. I mean, I don't think it's a company's right to just because they're afraid or just because they can't deliver what their customers want, because that's basically what's at stake here. If they can't deliver what a lot of customers want, then that's their problem and not mine. And I don't think it should give them the right to limit my rights, basically, because my right is to buy whatever copy I want, install it on whatever I want, and resell whatever I want, as long as I don't break the standard copyright, you know, the default copyright law, in my case, of the Netherlands. And I don't really see why Apple should get, or even any other company, the same thing. I mean, especially if you read a lot of Mac forums, people are very adamant about Apple's EULA and saying that it's really, you know, it's very important, and Apple's EULA is right, and people should not be able, or it's against the law even, some say, to install Mac OS X on non-Apple machines. But if you say that, if you allow Apple to make such restrictions, then you get a lot of other crazy restrictions that you find in end-user license agreements of all sorts of vendors. I mean, for instance, Microsoft Office can only be run on Windows, according to the EULA. So you're not allowed to run it on
that. Reminds me of something, actually. Apple accidentally, when they shipped iTunes for Windows, they accidentally included the Mac
Safari.
OS X. Oh, sorry, it was Safari, wasn't it?
Safari
for Windows.
Safari.
They accidentally included the OS X EULA, so it said that you can only run this on an Apple computer.
Yeah, exactly. That's the kind of, you know, that's the kind of.
Do they have to bring in all those customers and sue them because they broke the law?
There was another one. The Windows end user license agreement. I'm not entirely sure if it's only for the test versions, the beta and RC versions, or also for the full versions. But they contain a clause that says that you're not allowed to publish benchmarking information about Windows.
Oh, and that's extremely common in enterprise software. I wouldn't hesitate to say that almost all enterprise software has kind of a gag order in the license agreement about things like you're basically not even allowed to talk about your enterprise software. You know, if you have Oracle or SAP or something, you know, you're not even allowed to talk about it. You're not even allowed to tell people that you're using it, I think.
Yeah, and I think that's
getting permission.
Yeah, but those are all sorts of things that if you know, if you approve of Apple's at Ulan what they're doing, then you're also automatically approving of all of those things as well. And I think that's completely ridiculous. And I find that kind of slightly disturbing if you know where that trend would go, because right now we can all more or less comfortably say that we don't care about Nayula, but if they get validated in some way by a court of law, then
I have kind of a nuanced view of this whole thing. I actually don't think that it's wrong. I don't think that Apple has any responsibility to, you know, to make sure that other people can use their operating system.
Let me just say that first thing. No, I don't mean to say that Apple should make it easier or should think about me when I do that, or should think about PsyStar when they're writing their software, but they should not sue them, for God's sake. I mean, that's completely ridiculous. I find that a completely out of worldly kind of thing.
I think just to sum up what my feelings are, is I think that the types of provisions that you can put into a license agreement have to have some sort of limit. And this isn't without legal precedent. You can make a contract. I'm talking just about U.S. law right now, which is what I know a little bit better. But you can... you and I, Tom, we could have a contract, and we could stipulate a vast array of really crazy things that you and I would agree to in writing, and it would be legally binding. However, there are limits on what can be included in a contract. For example, we can't enter into a contract that would end up where you give up any of your basic civil rights in that contract. I can't enslave you through a contract. Indentured servitude is actually something that used to be allowed in contract law in the past, but is no longer allowed. You can't give up your basic civil rights. And there are all kinds of contracts that are existing out there in the world that are actually not legal. They're not legally binding because you're not actually allowed to do that. And so the fact that there you can allow a licensing agreement in your laws and the laws of your country, but that some provisions of that licensing agreement can't be upheld, is really a very basic thing as far as legal philosophy goes, and I think that's basically what it comes down to with these software licenses. The whole idea of a software license is sound, but there are some limits on what can be specified in those licenses. Our biggest problem is we just don't know the law around those isn't developed enough so that everybody really knows what's allowed.
I think there's another problem on top of that. I mean, because I think there are a lot of laws. I'm not entirely sure about the Netherlands, but I know in a lot of other countries where you're not allowed to add restrictions that are only revealed post sale and that you have to agree to post sale. So. I mean, I don't have. If Apple were to offer me their license as part of the sales agreement, of the sales, basically that's also a contract. The sales agreement is a contract technically. If they were, the retailer, because we don't have official Apple stores here, so if the retailer were to offer me that contract under my nose and I had to sign it, then it would be a completely different story. I mean, then I'm actively, signing a contract, and if after that I get bitten by that contract, then it just means I didn't read very well, or I was just being an idiot. But this is just stuff that gets shoved down your throat. I mean, when you're already back home and you're already, took off the shrink wrap and you're already thrown in the CD, you've started the installation, and there's no other way to go than to, accept that stupid window before you can install. And I think that's kind of weird. I mean, it should be part of the sale. I mean, I know that would be very problematic for software companies, but again, I don't care about companies. I mean, it's their license agreement. If they want to make it valid, offer it to me as part of a sale. And if that poses problems in, for instance, online retailership, or if, in stores that aren't specifically Apple retailers, but just regular stores that also happen to sell Apple stuff, that's their problem, not mine. So
yeah, and actually the big difference between Oracle, for example, if the Oracle license agreement says, oh, you can't publish benchmarks, there actually is a big difference there, and that is you actually have to sign a contract before you get your Oracle software. And that puts it on much stronger legal footing than shrink wrap contracts, which really aren't contracts at all.
That said, we can obviously talk about what is morally right and what should be right and what the law says is right, but reality is a very different beast. And what actually happens as far as what we all know about what should be the right way of doing things and what the law says is should be right, it doesn't happen that way, unfortunately. We live in a world where justice is lopsided, and you have to just get by with whatever good happens happens and deal with what bad happens. And the thing is with this Sci-Star case and the things with EULAs and shrink wrapped contracts, etc., it is all wrong, but we're not going to, how can I put it, in the world of computing, the wrong thing is what is default. You have to work hard to do the right thing. Companies have to work hard to do the right thing. Users have to work hard to do the right thing. It isn't the right thing is not the default action. So things like, in the UK, no, shrink wrap EULAs are not legal. But that doesn't mean that, that shops and manufacturers, etc., are upholding that. They're not. They're just carrying on along as normal. And we just have to wait for court cases to actually then get these things decided. And the court cases are not ideal because they're put in front of a jury of people who have no clue about the technology underhand. And the law, despite what it says, is not based on morals. It's based on facts. So the right thing doesn't happen. So unfortunately, I don't see a very nice future where things like the problem, the issues that we're discussing are ever going to come to a good solution. I can only see that as time goes on, and as the generation we have now grows up, we're going to get used to an environment of privacy invasion, and we're going to get used to an environment where we don't own anything. And
no, I don't actually think that's going to happen, because if you even look at the popularity of the Pirate Party in Sweden. I mean, they got a seat in the European Parliament, and there aren't enough geeks and nerds in Sweden to account for such a large voting percentage for that party. That's not right. So there are a lot of people who are not like us, who are not geeks, but normal people, who are also worried about privacy. And I think that's only going to grow, because even if I walk around the street here or I talk to people here in the Netherlands, a lot of people are actually worried about things like privacy. Even people who have nothing to do with computing, nothing. Even old people, young people, everybody is worried about the government and companies knowing too much about us or being too controlling. So I don't think we're ever going to get into a world where everything is controlled and everything is like we know, where everybody knows everything and privacy is invaded. I actually think that the pendulum is going to swing the other way, because the government, at least the government in the Netherlands, but I also realize that it's happening a lot in the United Kingdom, where the government is impeding too much on individuals and families and everything. And I think the pendulum is now on the wrong side, basically, and the pendulum is going to swing back to where the government retreats and companies have to retreat in order to give people more privacy, actually, instead of less. It's kind of a thing that moves back and forth, and I think we're in the future going to go to a time where the pendulum is going to swing all the way to the other side, which hope.
Can I suggest a change of subject?
Yeah, uh-huh. I was going to say that anyway. Actually, I think we should try and move on to something Linux related so that Tess can get a word
That was my suggestion. We had a couple of topics on OS News this week. One of them was the issue of Linux user friendliness, and the other one somewhat similar, which is the issue of the Linux desktop being too much like Windows, or I thought maybe we could discuss those issues.
Yeah, I'm going to step back for a while now. I did my thing with the X thing.
Yeah, I'm not too fond of talking about Linux again, not after the last two shows.
I'm perfectly okay with it. I'm just gonna, just let you people speak, and I'll.
Well, I'm not sure exactly where to stand on this particular issue, because in the desktop computing world, we've had a long-standing history of people coming up with an idea that gets copied by someone else, that gets copied by someone else, that gets copied by someone else, and it goes on and on and on in that fashion. I mean, a lot of the desktop compositing effects that I saw first came from the Linux platform and then were moved to other platforms where it became more standard. I don't find Expose all that particularly interesting because I've had it for years on Linux and it doesn't really make any much difference to me. It certainly could use some more refinement, but I don't think that there's anything inherently wrong with making an operating system like another system, or making a program like another program. I don't think that there's anything inherently wrong with it. The problem becomes when we actually have that as our only goal. If
yes.
we do that to the exclusion of any
else.
Other innovation, that is where the bad starts. But if we maintain that, well, we can start with this, but let's see if we can make this better. Or what if we have a good idea along the way that makes us want to rethink a lot of the things that we conceived of as standard? I don't think there's anything wrong with this.
Sometimes you can do something totally new or totally different, totally unique, and you know that's not always the best thing. You know, earlier in this podcast, Tom was talking about how he finds the Gmail interface confusing, and the truth is that it is confusing because with Gmail they fiddled around with some of the longstanding conventions of managing email, an email workflow, and a lot of people find it great, but other people don't.
Mm-hmm.
And that's always the danger. You know, there are some very smart people working on Linux, and they could go and just challenge all of the conventions, kind of some of the desktop conventions that have been established and refined by Apple and Microsoft.
Mm-hmm.
And would I don't know with how much of a favor that would be doing everything to kind of try to turn everything over onto its head.
Even within, we saw this in the KDE world. I happen to like KDE 4. I liked KDE 3.5 as well. But the change in how it operates and how it thinks was enough to alienate a lot of users. And I'm not going to get into the issue about 4.0 being more or less a developer's release, okay? I'm not going to get into that issue. But I really like the changes in the way that they made KDE 4 work differently. I thought that was a great improvement, and it made me a lot more interested in it as a desktop environment. But it does tend to cause divisions within users. Who likes the newer version? Who just doesn't get it and just wants something to work?
And then, of course, there's the issue that I brought up in my AskOS news article about the difference between something being user-friendly and something being beginner-friendly, which I think is an issue that really gets confused a lot. That just because everything has, you know, buttons and menus and it's easy to figure out, doesn't actually make it more user-friendly than something that may take you 10 or 15 minutes to get your head around.
Right. Users are not monolithic. They're very different. They have different ways of looking at it, and some users are on different levels than other users.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not a particular fan of the command line, for instance, but when it comes to installing applications in Debian-based distributions, because I'm really a fan of apps, then I really prefer managing my application through the command line and using apt-get and everything.
Oh, me too.
BKT, that's because it's much easier and much faster for that particular task. But I know that for a lot of people who are new to Linux, that's not a preferable way of managing their applications. And neither is Synaptic, by the way, which is a very complicated, very convoluted, and very not beginner-friendly application.
No.
You can do a lot with it, but it's not very beginner-friendly. And I think that really illustrates kind of the point that David's trying to make, that there's indeed a very big difference between user-friendly and beginner-friendly, because I know there are a lot of die-hard Unix people who will prefer a completely, you know, a command line or screen-based environment, and I think it's, you know, it's in the bee's knees. That's what I wanted to say.
One thing that I'd like to point out about this is another thing that's different between the proprietary world and the open source world is that in the proprietary world, you can hire someone that can be a designer and go out and ask users how to go and do this. Now, you can do something like that. In fact, KDE4 did an entire Plasma artwork effort prior to making the first release in order to get people who weren't developers to help them and assist them create this new operating system. And I think that more projects need to do that. They need to crowdsource their concepts of what they need to do. And from that crowdsourcing, they might be able to pick and choose what sort of things make the most sense and might work the best for them, or at least go with the overall vision of what they want to do for the product.
Gosh, I'm sorry. I'm not very slow today.
Well, I mean, what was the other? We talked about user friendliness, and then we also talked about what's about being similar to the Linux desktop being too much like Windows or Mac OS X, and that's kind of a very weird issue because at some point,
I think
of course it's.
I think this goes back to my comment in the last podcast that the Linux world is still more or less in its teenage years. It wants to rebel. It wants to be different than everyone else. And point of fact, it is different than anyone else. It works differently. It thinks differently than Windows and Mac. It works different. Now, does it bear some vague resemblance? Sure, I'm going to give you that. But at the same time, is that really that important from a long-term perspective? This just seems like we're trying to rebel against every little convention that was ever possibly used.
I remember I was going to mention there is because one of the things I've been trying to think of one of the things I've been trying to address with this is the idea that Linux is perceived as always being copying Windows and everything and as Tess said, the negative being that you can get caught following someone's tail and that being your only purpose, a lot like what OpenOffice does. And I was trying to think if there's got to be a good example of something that Linux is doing is where they are making their own decisions and going in their own directions. And I just remember was reminded of
Symphony
a topic
OS
cover,
is one
which
of
was,
them.
Moblin, something like that.
Oh yeah, that.
Yeah. So that's
K-Office.
Doing a lot
K-Office.
Of
K-Office. K-Office is another K-Office.
Yeah, a lot
the,
of doing,
the new K-Office
doing a lot of their
UI
own
is very nice. Actually, it would work beautifully on a widescreen monitor and gives you a lot more vertical scrolling space. I actually thought that interface was really rather brilliant.
And I think what happens is that when we get a new... Sometimes you need a clean slate. If you're a designer, you need a clean slate. And we get that with when we get new hardware platforms coming out. You get a new slate in which you can design something fresh, and you don't have to copy the previous systems and everything. So we've got these netbooks that have come out, and whilst we've stuck traditional operating systems on them, there is a lot of room there to design something new, and I think Linux has stepped up to that plate. It was a pretty disastrous to begin with, but then they were just shipping existing technology. But something like Moblin and Netbook Remix, they've
all the cloud.
Or the thing that KDE is currently developing, the netbook interface developed by KDE, which really, if you want one thing that really shows off just how
do you have
flexible
a link for that?
And it was on Ars Technica somewhere.
Oh,
it's
to me.
Let me find it real quick. You guys just keep on talking. I'll find it.
Well, I think that Linux promoters have a. There's an inherent challenge, and it's kind of you have to go either one way or the other. If you're going to try to get people to use Linux without them having to really stretch or expand, then you do have to kind of slavishly copy. You do have to slavishly copy Windows, for example, and have something that works very, very similar to Windows, so that people can use it. And can be immediately familiar with it and won't get scared off by the difference. But then on the other hand, you can try to do the exact opposite, and you can come up with something totally different, so that people see it the way that they'll see any other new thing without the kind of the expectation
that it's
going to work the way.
Is if you think of the difference between appliances and computer interfaces, we are used to the traditional computer interface, the Windows, the same thing we've had since the 1980s, and we try and map that onto many different things, and it doesn't always work, or it works fine, but better solutions could be come by treating devices as appliances and in treating the software as an appliance rather than a bog standard desktop that should replicate something else. As I was saying in the article, you would not expect you do not expect your car to operate the same as your mobile phone or your computer or your washing machine. These are all appliances that have interfaces that are tailored to them, and the same is happening with netbooks. It doesn't matter that it's like Windows, as long as they can then can navigate it, and the more focused that interface is, the more like an appliance it is, the actually easier regular users find it.
Yes.
Yeah, right. The perfect example is mobile, because you know you have Windows Mobile, which tries to be like Windows and ends up being a disaster, and then you have iPhone OS or Web OS that try to be their own thing, and you know people don't have a hard time figuring out how to use the iPhone, and to do the same types of things they'll do on a computer in a very different way. Mm-hmm. It's just a question of you have to do it differently on purpose and try to use the strengths and weaknesses of your particular form factor. So I think there's a lesson there for Linux promoters.
Mm. But that's actually the reason why I wanted to bring up KD in the network discussion. But because Plasma is such a flexible, so configurable, and so easy to change and adapt, and it's not really Plasma, and I think the name Plasma actually illustrates that really well, that it's not solidified into a single form. I mean, when you use Windows Mac, when you use Windows Explorer, which is the Windows interface, or you use the Finder interface, or you use Gnome's interface, you're more or less forced into a certain paradigm. You can change a couple of things around, but you're all using the same thing in the end. But when you look at Plasma and KDE, there's just so much flexibility.
You want the K menu on the desktop? Go right ahead. There's nothing stopping you. You want a new K menu? Go right ahead and install that. We don't care.
Because everything is like a plasmoid, basically, and you can do so much stuff with it. That this whole network interface that they came up with, you can already do that now. I mean, you can sit down behind a normal KDE4 desktop, and you can move your stuff around and have it look exactly like that because it's that flexible. Mm-hmm. And I think that's, even though that is puzzling to people who switch to KDE, it was puzzling to me in any case, it also shows off the flexibility. And I think that when you look at the future, KDE in that in this regard, there's quite a bright future ahead of it, because it's so easy to adapt Plasma to different types of display or different display sizes or maybe even different input devices because it's so flexible. And I think that's
you would think that they would come up with a initial setup wizard that would run on the first time that you invoke the operating system allow you to select what kind of UI style you want.
Do you want 20 questions? It's just a nuisance. People skip through it. People should discover customization as they go. You can't shove customization up in people's faces to begin with because they don't know. They're not familiar with the system. They're not familiar with the way with things work. And they're not familiar with what they can change and what they can't change. So I think a wizard is a terrible way of changing any settings up front on a computer. Really, it should be about discoverability. You boot an iPhone up and you're there to explore. You'll find whatever you need to find as you go along. And
that's a good one, actually. If you've never used an iPhone before, try to find out how to manage applications. I found that one of the weird. Because my mother installed a number of applications because she actually has an iPhone, and she asked me to delete them, and because she didn't know how to do that. And I had that thing in my hands for 30 fucking minutes before I found out that you have to tap and hold, and then the application start like the icons start bouncing around, and then you can delete them. It's completely counterintuitive and absolutely not discoverable at all. So the features don't even have to be discoverable for people to be able to use them. So I mean, that was really weird. Or the same thing in the iPhone, if you want to enter a URL. In Safari, you also have to press and hold. I find that very weird, and I didn't find that discoverable at all. It took me 20 minutes to find that one out. Probably. Yeah, true.
True. Good point.
Yeah, that's what a lot of reviewers said about the WebOS, which of course also does multitasking and has a lot of features which aren't immediately discoverable, but once you know them, you can't live without them. That's basically what WebOS was doing, and probably the iPhone is the same thing with you know, having to tap and hold and all that sort of stuff that's explained, just, you know, you can't find it anywhere. You just have to find that out somehow.
I think all of this really gets down to a few basic issues that design needs some thinking put to it. You can't just do any sort of thing. You need to do that. And you have to assume that there has to be some mentorship along the way. If there's no mentorship and you focus completely on making it easy from the beginnings, you might upset your advanced users who don't care about how easy it is to do most common day things. They want to do something more advanced. It's really a combination of trying to come up with a design that works very well and is very flexible for the vast majority of the bell curve of your users, but you still have to consider a way to mentor the users who need more help to get them up to that bell curve where they feel comfortable using the system.
Well, sometimes your community can do that for you. One of the things I like about macOS X, and one thing I'm going to find interesting about Snow Leopard, is I'm still learning new things 2 years down the line. You discover little oddities that they've put in there that are either completely undocumented or you would never know in a way we would normally discover, and you learn these from one person to another. They can show you these things, like the fact in macOS X you can hold shift when you're changing the audio to do micro changes to the audio instead of the full click. And in Snow Leopard specifically, when you open Exposer, you can press the one key or two key to order them alphabetically or by some other type, and things like that. That's there's no UI for that whatsoever, but you just pick up these little tips from here and there, other people from websites and so forth, and it's nice to have them there, but they're not vital. You don't have to have that functionality. It only makes things easier when you find them out.
Windows is really good at that. Windows is filled with all sorts of features that nobody knows about. But if you just go onto Google and try to, if you ever wonder if Windows can do something or has a certain little feature, it's a big chance that it actually has it, but that it is hidden somewhere very, very deep in 10 million menus or in somewhere far away in a directory that nobody knows about. It comes with so much stuff that a lot of people don't know. Of course, I can't come up with an example right now. You'll always see that, but a lot of operating systems are that way, and desktop environments too. There's a lot of hidden stuff that you don't know about unless you actually try and find it and need it, and then you go into Google and you enter that feature, and then suddenly it turns out that everybody has it, but it's just in some weird place that you never expected it to be.
And Ubuntu has been working towards that, but the KDE side of the desktop universe, and I know I'm completely ignoring all of the other ones like XFCE, but they... We really need to do better in that. We need a lot more UI mentorship in terms of what all of these different DEs can actually do and how we can help users actually become comfortable with this.
And we should also help, they should also help distributors, especially KDE, which is now quite advanced, but even the default KDE setup and the default that a lot of distributors choose, they don't really seem to know what to do with all the flexibility that KDE4 gives them. They just, you know, try to make it look as much as previous KDEs as possible, completely neglecting, completely ignoring all the advanced stuff that they could do with it to make it easier for their users.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's not just up to the developers, but also, especially in the case of Linux, of course, also the case of the distributors to extract as much power from especially KDE4, but to a much lesser degree Gnome. To extract all the power and flexibility that they actually have. They don't seem to use that.
I spent a couple of days trying to find a KDE distro that was usable. I downloaded four or five different distros. I started off with the obvious one, Kubuntu, and I tried out Fedora, and I tried OpenSUSE, because I was trying to do some browser testing with Conqueror, and oh my days, it was horrendous. Yeah, they haven't got it licked at the moment. KDE KDE-based distros are completely... atrocious, terribly maintained, don't work out of the box, terrible defaults. It's so bad when compared to GNOME, and I hope that they get that sorted, because so far I've had so many horrendous experiences with KDE over the years. I would like to give KDE4 a go, but I need the right distro that gets it right, that gets something that works out of the box and gets the default sane.
Yeah, that's going to take a while, I think, because it's always funny to go to planetkde.org and look at all the screenshots those people have, because they're always beautiful and all sorts of, you see all sorts of advanced and cool stuff, and then you download the distribution and you realize that all that advanced stuff is what those people who actually develop KDE are doing themselves, but distributors are not using that functionality to a great degree. And I think that's That's kind of a shame, because I actually like KDE 4. I really like all the stuff that you can do with it, but it's not exposed properly by, not just by the KDE developers themselves, but mostly by the distributors, who just don't seem to know what to do with all the power they're suddenly given. I mean, KDE 3 was relatively easy in that regard. I mean, you just made it look like Windows and you were done, but KDE 4 has so much stuff to offer that distributors kind of overwhelmed with what they can do with it and then just kind of make a mess of it, basically.
And they probably don't really pay too much attention to it, because that's not really what they're trying to sell you.
No, it's true.
They probably give it all of 15 minutes configuration before they actually said, okay, ready, go gold master it.
I think a lot of the world's problems with beginner users on computers could be solved by just setting some defaults, right? Good grief. I know I could put myself out of a job if I was the one who set up the OEM gold masters for Windows quite easily, because I would just set it up, configure all the settings right, put the right software on there instead of all this shovelware, all this crapware on the computers, and I'd be out of a job because people would have so few problems.
Oh yeah, because you fix.
I do, yes, well, I say I fix computers. What I actually do is I fight against companies who make stupid decisions. I do that day in, day out. All I am doing is reverting bad defaults. I'm removing software that doesn't need to be there. I'm getting rid of bloat. I'm setting up the security as it should have been in the first place, and things like that. All I'm doing is if the company's got their act together, they would put me out of a job. But I don't see it happening.
Yeah, my parents have an Acer laptop, and it took me a total of fracking 2.5 hours to get all the crapware removed. Two and a half hours.
Sony.
I mean,
I just installed Linux.
Yeah, but I couldn't give my parents that. I mean, I don't want to. I mean, my father switched to Mac now, but I mean, my parents are Windows people. I'm not going to force them to use something they don't want to use. So I had to remove all the crap, and that was 2.5 hours of work, and that was
maybe one or two Mac jobs a year. Compared to full-time work with PCs.
Yeah,
and it's not that people are stupid. Users are not stupid. And they're not doing anything particularly wrong.
Yeah,
it's the setup is
wrong.
Something
that
they're starting on the wrong foot, and they're stumbling over silly things that the companies have put in place.
Yeah, I really hate it when people on internet forums, when people who are very advanced say that normal users are stupid. Well, normal users are people like your dad, son. I mean, you can't just you wouldn't call your dad stupid to his face, would you? It just means that if a user can't use your product, then it's not the user's fault, it's the product's fault. That's basically the end of it.
It's not entirely the product's fault either. It's the mentorship. If you don't actually also couple proper design with proper mentorship, how is any of our parents going to be able to figure this stuff out? I mean, there's a running joke between me and my dad that the reason why he bought a computer for me when I was 5 years old is so that he could extract free tech support for me for the rest of his life. It's worked out very well for him.
Oh god! Technically, the same thing with me and my parents, because I manage all their computers, and I've got like 3 or 4 of them, and I manage all of them, including my mother's iPhone. So it's kind of the same thing. I mean, they bought computers for us, and now we're basically their free tech support for the rest of our lives.
Really, these things should be easy enough for people to do it, because again, they're not stupid. It's bad design, and we're talking obviously about is Linux easier to use than Mac OS X or Windows, but really we should be saying are any desktop environments easier to use? Period.
Not really.
I don't think they are.
No.
But the problem is, you can't find something that. I think the reason the desktop metaphor has stuck around so much is because it scales well. You can do basic things that you can do on an iPhone with multi-touch, but then the desktop environment also scales up to using something like Photoshop, where you have infinite complexity and precision. And the difficulty is that whenever we've come up with an alternative system, an alternative metaphor, like on the iPhone and mobile OSs and things like that, they don't scale enough to cover all of the things that we currently do with our desktop systems anyway. Like Photoshop, I think, is probably one of the best examples. If you can invent a system where you can completely redesign Photoshop and it still be as productive and finitely precise, then you will have solved the desktop problem.
The issues with Photoshop go a little deeper than just that, because it's made by Adobe, and I think that kind of is the biggest problem with Photoshop is that it's made by Adobe. I think that's
The personal computer, both its triumph and its tragedy, is its flexibility.
Yes.
And you know, the reason that the personal computer became the important aspect of our kind of cultural and technological life that it did is because it's so flexible, and because you can do things with a personal computer that the inventors of the personal computer never in their wildest dreams could have imagined. And that's because of its openness and its flexibility. But yeah, that's also the tragedy. It is so open and flexible that it's daunting in its complexity, or it's daunting in its capability for chaos, which is really the problem that we have.
And that's probably also why car analogies in computing generally don't hold up and generally don't work, because a car is a relatively simple piece of machinery compared to a computer, because it can go forwards and backwards, and you can turn your steering wheel, but it's got a relatively limited set of how to control a car, and they all operate more or less the same, except if you buy a
BMW, in which case it's notoriously complex. But even the BMW, the notoriously complex BMW iDrive interface is quite a bit simpler, quite a bit simpler than a personal computer.
It's appliances again, but what's made the personal computer such a success is the fact that it's kind of like, it's not that it's not just that the end user can do anything with a computer. It's that anyone, any third party, can do anything with somebody's computer. It's like shipping someone a proto board, and you being able to send them something that can turn that product into another product, rather than having to sell lots of individual appliances. The customer has an appliance which can become any appliance, which is an incredible thing, which is, like I think, David, you were talking about when we were doing the Apple podcast, about the wild west of programming, that suddenly had this device, that a customer had a device that I can think up an idea, and I can sell that idea to a customer. I don't have to create a real appliance that they have to buy. I can send them software, and their appliance becomes whatever I want it to be. That's why it's such a brilliant device.
But it's a recipe for chaos and confusion, and that's what we have. And we've spent 25 years now trying to refine, trying to corral the chaos and trying to refine the interface. And I guess kind of to try to bring this conversation full circle, we're now in a situation where operating systems don't really need any more features, but I'm certain that we can pull a couple more decades of refinement.
I think what's going to happen
and continue to get people to buy operating system upgrades
just by
continuing to perfect and refine and simplify, in a lot of ways, the user experience.
Well, in that case, Microsoft has their coming 10 decades.
They've set themselves up pretty well.
Yeah, because there's a lot of stuff. I mean, even though I like Windows 7, there's still 10 billion million things that they could do better. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of stuff that they can refine on that end.
I think pattern holds with the future is that we're going to see a division. The desktop will never go away, not ever, not within our capability to foresee the future or predict the wild. But we're going to see a division of more appliances. I think operating systems are going to move. We're going to see more appliance operating systems appear, like the iPhone, like Moblin, like this KDE work, etc. So we're going to have more and more devices that have unique operating systems specifically designed for them, and then we're all always have a desktop operating system for Photoshop, basically.
Yeah, probably. I should probably quit this topic. Is there anything else that we, any of us in particular, want to cover?
Not particular. I'm running a little low on time over here.
Let's wrap it up. It's been a good conversation.
Okay, fantastic. Let's cover the final meta. We, as always, any emails you have for us, please email us at osnews-crew@osnews.com. And what else? There's Twitter. You can follow us on Twitter, although what we say on Twitter is nothing really to do with OS News. You can follow me at twitter.com/croc, K-R-O-C.
Yeah, you can follow me at /TomHoverda, and again, spelling is on the website.
You can find me at myself at denonet.org.
And you can follow David on the website.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, I'm not thinking right. Okay, that should be everything. Let's just get this shipped out and then see what the comments are. That'll be the interesting part of it. Because I can't really remember anything we've covered. I think we're all going to discover what the podcast was about after we've actually listened to it.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff in here in a relatively short time. Because how long have we been recording?
One hour, 20 minutes.
Yeah.
Thereabouts.
So there's a lot of stuff that we've covered, even though I indeed can't recall what exactly.
Someone rewind the podcast and provide us an outline.
Yeah. Exactly.
Alrighty, peeps. Okay. Thank you all very much, and we'll see you all next week.
Yeah,
thank you.
See you on the back. Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye.